Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Things We Read This Week. My name is Jordan Nanos. I'm here again with Hunter Almgren. We got a full episode this week. We're going to start by talking about what it's like to move off of VMware onto KVM or some other options there. Then we're going to go to the classic AI corner. We're going to try and stay away from AI for a few minutes, at least at the beginning of this episode. We'll have to have an update on DeepSeek, on Stargate, and how people are using these AI-powered products. But anyway, Hunter, how's it been these last 2 weeks? What you've been working on?
Surprisingly, a lot of alternative hypervisor projects. I've been talking to people who I think have had upwards of 400% cost increases, I think is the highest that I've heard. And so it's really opened the conversation to like, what else is out there? Kind of sorting through the what is and isn't enterprise grade or production class, right? I mean, I've heard definitely from like the home lab community, people talking about Proxmox, but like having used that myself, like, I would never put that in production. It lacks so many enterprise features. I mean, maybe if you're a small business, you can get away with it, sure. But like, you know, when you start layering on all of the change control processes and, you know, having to have integration into tools like Remedy and ServiceNow and, you know, backup plans and disaster recovery plans, like that's really where you start to see, you know, what is truly enterprise grade out there and what isn't, right? Like what can actually go up against VMware? And what was interesting to read was that it appears, at least publicly, the first, what I would call large company has completely moved away from VMware and onto KVM. So this Austrian cloud provider, Anexia, they have successfully moved 12,000 virtual machines to KVM. It's pretty sizable, right?
Yeah.
I would call that like a large environment. And, if you read through this article a little bit more, it actually talks about, you know, the fact that KVM can boot virtual machines using VMDK formats, right? So there's no like conversion that has to take place or anything like that. And they really talk about, if you look here, they didn't want to put a dollar amount to the increase precisely, but the register understands it exceeds 500% cost increase. So this would make this the highest that I've heard. This is becoming more and more of a conversation that I'm getting involved in, helping people understand, like, do you have a container strategy? Do you want to accelerate that? Maybe you've already gone down the path of something like OpenShift and you want to start accelerating that strategy of containerizing workloads. And then for everything that can't be containerized, maybe I'm an Azure customer. Maybe I start moving things to Azure Local, or maybe I'm maybe I want to take the plunge into KVM, but only for tier 2-3 workloads. I mean, everybody's going to be different, but I think it lends This cloud provider moving their entire environment to KVM, I think, lends credibility to KVM-based platforms being a viable alternative. Because if I can run a cloud provider scale, most enterprises can, I think, feel comfortable running with an enterprise-grade KVM-based platform.
Yeah, we'll talk about what that scale is. In that article, it said 12,000 virtual machines across 100 different locations, or more than 100 locations, right? Mm-hmm. I assume those are not small points of presence. This is data centers across Austria or across Europe serving many customers.
Yes.
So at that rate, we're talking about a few hundred virtual machines per location. If it's all dividing evenly, 12,000 by 100, right?
Yeah.
Which is, even if they're all 2V CPU, 4 gigs of RAM, that's still adding up to quite a bit of infrastructure across all those different locations.
100%.
So what's the, What's holding people back from doing this? Because 500% or like a 6x increase from VMware to KVM, or sorry, from VMware previously to VMware now, that's not actually the price of a KVM license. It's not like you save 6x. You possibly save more than that because KVM licensing was always less than VMware.
If you went and bought, like, what is it, Red Hat Enterprise Virtualization, they've now come out with a new product, I think, called like OpenStack Virtualization Engine or OpenShift Virtualization Engine, right? They've kind of rebranded that. If you bought that, right, like typically you're looking at socket licensing and you're looking at a far less cost, right? So it's not core based, it's socket based. And so right there, I know some companies that run extremely dense. I'm talking 300 VMs on a single host, right? So if I want to jam dual 128 core CPUs in a box and run 500 VMs on it, it's the same price whether I have 10 VMs or 1,000, right? I mean, I think that's
So
a big cost savings there too, or that contributes.
right. So we're looking at cost savings. If it's a direct comparison between the cost of a supported KVM distribution with like a dashboard control plane and a license, that's more than 10 times cheaper than the equivalent licensing for vCenter and ESXi from VMware
It
on the
could be.
simple state. The
Yeah. That
so the
tool, that tool that I sent you earlier this week, if you look at that even, right? That comparison tool, I mean, that puts basically KVM 15 times cheaper than a VCF license.
On a license comparison, but the obvious thing is that this is a TCO, and everybody says this open source is only free if you have the time. So you have to build up a skill set around KVM to be able to deploy that at scale. Clearly, this company with 12,000 VMs, who's a service provider, is able to build that skill set. Not to make this about AI, but Jensen said this couple of weeks ago, where he said he was on stage and doing some interview, and he was comparing performance between NVIDIA GPUs and AMD GPUs. And he said, the interesting thing is that even if our competitor sells their GPUs for $0, the TCO doesn't justify the move because they don't have the skill sets. They'd have to hire so many more engineers to actually do that work. What's the perspective on the skill set you would need? Like, what do you realistically need to move from VMware to KVM?
There's a lot of factors at play, right? If you, let's say, built your entire cloud automation strategy on Aria, which is VMware's automation platform, you're going to have a significantly harder time moving out, right? Because now you're talking about, well, I need all of these Aria ops, blueprints or whatever to be converted to a Terraform build plan or an Ansible playbook or something like that, right? Something that's more platform agnostic. And that takes a lot of time, right? You're talking about reskilling, right? You're talking about moving people from being, living in VMware land their entire career to learning platform agnostic tooling, because that is the KVM ecosystem, right? It's all platform agnostic tooling. I think what we're starting to see now, like with, the whole like HPE VM Essentials and OpenShift virtualization engine, right, is these like very robust GUIs around KVM that basically look, feel, and smell similar to a VMware-based management, right, and VMware-based control plane. So I think that is helping ease the transition or make it a little bit easier. But like if you've been living in the VMware land, right, it depends on how invested you are, how easy it's going to be to make the move. And so, and also it's going to dictate the level of skill set that you need. I think if, at a basic level, if you know how to install a distribution of Linux and a package, you can get KVM up and running. and get like the basic features and functionality. When you start layering in like software-defined networking, like if you want to transition from NSX to something else, right? Like my own personal experience is Open vSwitch is an absolute mess to learn. Like I don't, like I've spent like 3 weeks in it and I'm still confused, right? Like I just like, and the documentation is not clear and contradictory in some ways. So like, you know, if you're really heavy on software defined networking, like that could be another reason why it's going to be harder for you to move. But if you've already got an SDN strategy in place that I would say is a little bit more platform agnostic, or you've got some sort of nice GUI like wrapper around KVM that can handle that for you. Like, so for example, like within HPE VM Essentials, I have the ability to integrate with Cisco ACI controller, right? So like if I deployed ACI as my SDN strategy instead of NSX, well, that's not as easy or that's not as difficult of a move, right? Because I just hook the control plane up to ACI and now I'm good to go. Right. Like, but yeah, so I think those are considerations too, that are either going to make it not as cost-effective to move or damn near impossible. Right. I think those are factors that go into consideration. So again, to me, how invested are you in the VMware ecosystem? Do you have Linux people on staff, right? Like some customers do, some don't. You know, like, do you have Linux engineers, right? Do you have people that are familiar with managing Linux environments? If not, then it might be harder for you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, that the skill set is actually more like a Linux admin skill set than it is like a VMware admin skill set with the new options, because there's some amount of command line, there's some amount of automation with the API calls you're talking about making through Ansible or through Terraform or some sort of other provider. It kind of seems like there's three levels to this. There's the technical debt that's been built up on the automation side that some people just can't rewrite.
Yeah.
There's the familiarity. Like you have nice GUIs built, you have like integrations built with your ServiceNow and stuff, where, oh, it just kind of feels different and I don't like that yet. And then there's this third thing, which is like functionally, is the new tool capable of doing something that VMware could do that you now can't, which is to say, and there's always a spectrum there, because if it's possible to do it with Open vSwitch, but it's going to take you 3 months to do it, that's effectively the same thing as saying, no, it's not possible to do it.
VMware
could do, right?
Yeah, I agree.
I think the automation thing would be interesting to dig into more, because I mean, this is like, it's so funny that Broadcom can come along as a basically private equity play and just monetize people's tech debt.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an excellent way of putting it. Yeah.
You know who you've been telling people to rewrite their scripts so that it's not tied to this old clunky thing that you don't know when it's updates and it's a vendor? Yeah, actually, now you're going to pay us the price for not doing that.
I know. And this was like in the early days of like, you know, cloud, right? This was the big conversation of like, if you want flexibility, don't write your apps on Lambda. Like if you want the ability to move things, like don't develop in SageMaker, right? Like use open source tools that are platform agnostic. And it's the same with automation. It's like, don't write everything in Aria or what was formerly VRA, right? Like use Ansible, use Chef, use Terraform, right? Like use something that is platform agnostic. And you're right. Everyone just took the easy button and went, well, I'm just going to build VRA blueprints, which then migrate into Aria and everything's fine, right? Like, No, it's not fine. You're fucked. Like you basically chained yourself to this beast.
Yeah, interesting, man. So what I don't mean to make everything about AI, but what do you think the impact of a coding assistant would be on somebody who's working on those scripts? Do you think there's a underestimation how hard it is to port some of this stuff? Do you think it's an overestimation because, hey, I've got a coding assistant that knows Ansible and can kind of teach me about this new thing while I'm doing it? Are people accurately assessing how hard the move is going to be? The whole thing about a migration to some new tool is that, like, you have no idea how hard it is until you go do it. People are off by like factors of 10 all the time. Hey, I thought this was going to take 3 months. It took me 2 days because it was actually easier than I thought. Or I thought this would take a week. It's been a year and we're still trying.
And we saw this exact scenario play out with like the whole, replatforming in-house custom applications to be containers and microservices when that was the hot topic, right? They're like, oh, it'll take a year to refactor this application. 5 years later, it's still not refactored. So we saw this
But a
exact
lot of
same.
people have CKA
Yeah,
certifications.
exactly. With
I heard
the
this story
coding.
one time from this guy who was at KubeCon. He's like, we paused development of any new features on our application for a year. Everybody went and got a Kubernetes certification. We got the CKA, we got the CKAD. We all are Kubernetes experts at writing microservices. It's been a year. I have no idea what we accomplished.
That's amazing. I
Like,
think
yeah,
the,
actually, this is for Greenfield only, I guess.
yeah, I think the coding assist, well, so it's interesting because like IBM, for example, right? I mean, they've really been pushing their whole cloud pack thing, which is like, I took a legacy application and made it containers and microservices. But the problem with that is like, if I look at their Hadoop cloud pack, it deploys like 350 containers. One cloud pack. And I'm like, what does all this shit even do? I don't understand why you need this many containers to run what, eight tools? Like, is that the Hadoop tool chain now? Right? Like, so there's that
Oh my God, man.
approach.
The amount of people who spin up these like clusters with like 500 vCPU to run Spark so that they can run like jobs with 8 gig workers, like 3 8 gig workers is crazy. It's cr
I
everybody's
know.
got their own Spark cluster. It's
I
crazy.
know. I know. It's wild. But going back to your question about like, does AI coding assistance make it easier to transition? I don't know. Because like what I really haven't dug into like is okay, like let's say I wrote all of my automation in PowerShell, and I want to transition to Ansible because I don't want to be locked into Microsoft's ecosystem. Can I just feed an LLM a PowerShell script and go make this an Ansible playbook?
My
You
that my
can.
under yeah.
You can do that,
Yeah.
but the accuracy of it, I question in some cases, right? Because I've seen LLMs decide that apparently critical functions in the script are no longer necessary and just removes them completely. So I would say that the transition might not be as easy because you still need someone who knows Ansible to look at it and go, is this
You got to
correct?
test it. You got to run it. I really feel like the okay, so you have to have somebody who's motivated to make the move happen. It's not an agent that can go replace the person. Okay, we could go on to Zuckerberg's article that or the article about Zuckerberg saying he's gonna fire every engineer and replace them with agents. Or the Y Combinator company they're funding, which is apparently going to go acquire. You see that? I don't think I sent this, but they said they were going to fund this startup that was going to go acquire old software businesses, fire the engineers, and replace them with AI agents.
I did see that.
And then somebody responded saying, I'm going to fire the CEO of this startup and replace him with an agent. At some point, there's a human with some cognitive function making some decisions about what to tell the agents to do. And the point is, I guess, somebody needs to be motivated to port like you were saying, a PowerShell script or an REF script into an Ansible playbook. And I think if people are motivated to make that move, my personal experience has been that learning something new, a new programming language, a new domain that you're writing software for, is vastly easier when you have an assistant, an intern that can basically Google search immediately and summarize stuff for you. And even if it doesn't get you 100% of the way there with a click of a button, I think it's possible that technical debt has been underestimated for a long time and suddenly shifted to being overestimated in a way.
Yeah, I mean that's a fair point, right? And I love that example because, if I'm gonna sit down and I'm gonna learn, let's say, Ruby because I wanna write chef recipes now instead of Ansible playbooks, like I can do things like take an example chef recipe and highlight it and go like, what does this code do? Right? So that when I'm looking at it, like I'm understanding as I'm going, like what I'm looking at, how it functions, what the relationship is between, functions and variables and how I declare them, all that, all that kind of stuff, right? Like where do I put my environment variables, right? Like or like when do I get to the app customization section of the chef recipe, right? Like I can ask an LLM assistant all of these questions as I'm going and pick up on things much faster. So like I love that example because I think that's a really good example of how I think people can gain value from using these coding assistants and also maybe decrease their estimates on how hard it would be to move to something like a KVM.
Yeah, so what do you think of this, the concept of mid-level software engineers being the one who automated away? That's the article from Zuckerberg that I'm referencing there on screen, but it's like the idea that they're going to replace mid-level software engineers seems wrong to me. It seems to me like the people who will be replaced are basically very junior folks or very senior folks, almost the exact opposite, where a very senior person who has total complete understanding of the code base, knows some old janky language, knows some old database, whatever they need to work with, suddenly a mid-level person can learn that stuff pretty quickly with some documentation, with a coding assistant, right? But a junior person can't learn it because they don't even have the basic skills to be able to reason about, what this software is, what it is doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a junior dev and you just sit around and write unit tests all day, like you're probably going to be out of a job. Like,
Yeah, exactly. So I think this, the other thing is that everybody seems to kind of be treating AI in two ways simultaneously. They say it's going to increase global GDP and it's going to make all of these companies a lot more efficient and hire less people. Which is, one's inflationary, one's deflationary. So it doesn't make sense to me. And the thing about technology over time, great book I can reference called Thinking in Systems. The idea is that there's systems that are self-reinforcing, which is like if the price of a TV goes down over time, right? You produce more TVs and there's more money made in the industry and more people have TVs around the world, right? It's actually not a race to the bottom the same way that people think it is because the pie expands. And so people see this AI stuff and they're like, It's going to automate away all the software engineers. And maybe Meta can be more lean and mean, but generally speaking, I would expect Meta to launch new features, more products, hire more engineers, hire more product managers, hire more people who understand software, and over time, have them just be more effective. They do both. They grow as a company, they hire more engineers, they use more GPUs, they use more models, as opposed to they bring in more GPUs, more models, and they start firing everybody until what? Only Zuck remains?
Zuck and his brain LLM interface that he uses to write all the code for Meta platforms.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I don't get it. But anyway, I think maybe I took it too off topic on the VMware to KVM transition. It's so common and it's so impactful to so many companies bottom line right now, where there was a line item on all of these CSPs balance sheet that was basically, you know, budget spent on VMware.
Yeah.
Yearly license cost. Right.
Yep.
And it seems like that budget line item is either going up a lot and making people unprofitable, or it's going to go down a lot and the line item for employees or consultants is going up.
Yeah.
And that may result in my mind, people being motivated to try new things and the line item for GPUs also going up on that budget, right?
For sure, for sure. I think that, you know, if you, like, let's say, deployed your own in-house coding assistant and then decided I was going to use that to help make the transition from VMware to KVM easier, I think that you could get there a lot quicker, and you might be surprised at how quickly you get to, you know, the ROI target that you want.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you're just having people learn as they go, and you effectively have an expert sitting next to you in your IDE telling you, you know, answering your questions when you have them.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, okay, let's talk about experts then. The big news that we talked about on the last show in AI was DeepSeek. At that time, only V3 had come out. Now they've released their reasoning model, DeepSeek R1, with another tech report.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a lot of responses to this. I think the other thing is, I don't know if it's a direct response to this, but OpenAI and President Trump, the new President Trump, is also announced Stargate, a $500 billion data center project to build out AI infrastructure. I'll start by sharing that one, and then we can go to DeepSeek, but like, give me a high level reaction to this. On one hand, the DeepSeek guys say for about $5 million, they can train a model that's like number three on the chatbot arena, if not number one in some style control benchmarks, and has effectively, OpenAI has effectively confirmed that they're using the exact same reasoning approach that OpenAI is, just GRPO and reinforcement learning to the moon. US is going to spend $500 billion, stack GPUs, Chinese labs with, even if the rumors are true and they've got 50,000 H100s and are skirting export controls, it's still a side project. They don't have as many researchers or as much stuff. Like, how do we square this going forward? This, and it's open source. I mean, the DeepSeek model is just like, here's the weights.
Yeah. I think that there's just a general fear now over AI supremacy. You know, like, that's like the next geopolitical fight, basically. And I think that this Stargate investment is a direct response to that fear of China is producing a better model than Meta, we need to invest more money here to get Meta's to be the best one, or OpenAI's to be the best one, or, you know, pick your company, right? Like, I think that that's at least part of it is like, I forget, there was an article I read, I think 2 years ago or last year, about like the AI, it was called the AI arms race. Yeah. And it was about like how AI is going to affect like geopolitics, and like, you know, there's going to be this like race to supremacy in the AI space, like which country has the best AI, because it affects all these other things, right? I mean, you've heard about, you know, the military using AI with drones to do precision target strikes, you know, so that, you know, it has a direct effect on defense. There's all these other, like, I guess, like peripheral or adjacent use cases that would be a part of that. So I think that that's, at a high level, I think that that's where at least part of this investment is coming from, is like, we want the US to be the AI superpower.
Mm-hmm.
That's like my high level initial thought when I read this announcement.
Yeah. I think others in the industry made these comments just a few months ago. I think we talked about Dylan Patel on Dwarkesh Patel's podcast, basically saying like GPT-5 is going to be $100 billion training run, mm-hmm. or GPT-6 or whatever they're going to call the next stop. And they're making that investment. Microsoft's laying fiber between data centers. They're going to do multi-data center training. They're investing in nuclear power. We've been covering this. It is building up. I think the fascinating thing now is that the frontier is clearly not, you know, openly publicly demonstrated to not be between four American companies: Meta, Google, OpenAI, and Anthropic,
mm-hmm.
but to be between some collection of American companies, probably those four, and DeepSeek, a Chinese company.
Yeah.
Specifically, what they're describing, and you know, you never know if this is true, but they're describing as the side project of a quant firm in China, like a hedge fund.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's really interesting.
It is.
I can talk more about this. I want to say one thing about the actual training of the model in this new paradigm, because the way that OpenAI describes O1 has now kind of been revealed by the release of DeepSeek. The new one, just for people who don't know, DeepSeek R1 is a reasoning model, which means that it has a time to think about the response before it gives you a response. And many people have used this. The concept is broadly called chain of thought prompting, right? Like, the model is going to think about the question and reason about it before it actually gives you a final answer. OpenAI's O1 and O3 do this.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about OpenAI is that when you use it in their application, the chain of thought is not displayed. They hide that from the user. They just see the result.
Yeah.
With R1, because it's an open source model, people can run this locally, or you can go use the DeepSeek app, or you can use the free website, and you can see the chain of thought displayed right on screen. You can see what it's actually thinking about when it's trying to provide a response. And it's just like HTML tags, think, / think. Everything in between there is what it's reasoning about. It drastically improves the performance. The thing about all the other labs, specifically Meta, Anthropic, and Google, is that they were using supervised fine-tuning methods with like human written examples about how to approach the thinking process, right?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't just letting the model think and then improving it based on the right incentives. Both O1 and DeepSeek purely use reinforcement learning. So the thinking that the model does is emergent from its pre-training data. There's a little excerpt from a talk that I saw on Twitter from Sebastian Bubeck, who is, you know, at OpenAI, former VP and distinguished scientist at Microsoft. I don't know what his title is at OpenAI is, but his thing, no tactic was given to the model. Everything is emergent. Everything is learned through reinforcement learning. This is insane insanity. The people who know this best are describing this as insane insanity. And I'd invite everybody to just go use the model and see it have on screen a very human feeling aha moment when it's trying to think about a problem that you give it. Doing some math, something reasoning related, not like a Google search style, when did Broadcom acquire VMware? But a reasoning, how, like we were kind of describing before, how would I convert this PowerShell script to an Ansible playbook? Read the text that the models spits out. It's crazy. It's really, really crazy. I don't know what the conclusion is there, but I think this year of AI progress is going to get really weird, really interesting. And I think we can talk about some of the actual applications of a model like this beyond just a chatbot, right?
Well, and that's what that's what Mistral's CEO thinks we're going towards anyway, which is moving beyond AI models and moving into systems that integrate models in an agent-like fashion, right? So we're getting rid of or we're not caring about the model itself anymore, but we're caring about the integrated system of I've taken a model, I've given it contextual business data, and now it's an agent, right? That's where the Mistral CEO sees us moving over the course of this year.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I think we're already seeing this. So the other announcement from OpenAI, while DeepSeek is giving away models that beat theirs, is the what's it called? It's not Orchestrator. I keep forgetting the name.
Operator.
Operator. OpenAI Operator, which basically uses computer control, and you can prompt the model, order me Uber Eats, book a flight, something like that, and the model will go do it. This is directly in opposite, I would say, the what we talked about in the predictions episode and what I've seen in other domains. So I'll share something else here, review it quickly. Microsoft released a model on their research blog called MatterGen, which basically is yet another application of a transformer model to science. We saw this in weather forecasting, we saw this in protein folding, we saw this in playing video games. Now we see this in materials design, where the transformer model, specifically a diffusion model here, is just really good at performing tasks that used to be done with a combination of experts labeling data and expert systems.
And simulations, right? Like the company, what is it? Ansys has like literally made their entire company about running these simulations.
All sorts of computer-aided engineering tasks. So on one hand, the transformer model, if you design a custom model architecture, can be applied to a very specific problem and forecast the weather more accurately, predict protein structures, generate novel materials, play video games, all of the really hard tasks that we thought were left up to expert humans writing expert systems with rules built in and things like that, and just, basically replace massive supercomputers with relatively small GPU farms running a transformer model. But on the other hand, the general architecture for reasoning is being applied to other domains through operator with computer control, or through what you might call agents, where like the LLM has a tool that it can use, and that tool may be run a weather simulation or use Stockfish or you know, some other like Stockfish being a chess playing app, right? Anyway, it's interesting to see Mistral as a, I think that CEO probably has a perspective on what the company is going to be working on as far as they want to build a compound AI system that happens to include an LLM, but the purpose of it is to be a coding assistant, or is to be a data analyst, or is to be an accountant or a lawyer, paralegal, or something like that. And that's the sort of product that they will sell because they have some sort of proprietary model, data, training pipeline. They can build a better paralegal than somebody who's making API calls to the O1 model from OpenAI or something like
Well, and they
that, right?
probably can, given that doesn't Databricks own Mistral?
No. Mistral is still a startup,
Okay.
but
Who did
Databricks is
Databricks
definitely
buy?
doing this. They brought Mosaic ML to,
Mosaic ML, that's right. I was
but
I
it's,
another M company.
well, yeah. But I mean, at one point, MPT, at one point, I think last year, you know, Mosaic's pre-trained transformer, MPT, and Databricks,
MPT-7B, right?
it was state of the art.
Yeah.
They had StoryWriter, they had all this stuff. And Databricks, rumored, I don't know if this is confirmed, but they sold all their GPUs basically. They don't pre-train models. And at the time, it was because of Zuckerberg. And now I think it's because of DeepSeek. And so it's really interesting to see people pivot because Databricks or Mosaic still is a very large business training models. They just fine-tune the pre-trained Llama model for whatever their customer's business application is. And
Yeah.
clearly, there's a lot of material there because Databricks customers have a lot of data on their Databricks platform, right?
That's kind of where I was going with it, right? I mean, it's probably easier for a company like Databricks to help a customer fine-tune on their data set when the data is already in existence in Databricks, right? So like if you're a if you're an insurance company and you've got all of your information in Databricks and you want to create a virtual insurance agent based on, you know, policy data and like, you know, how past claims have been handled and like all that other type stuff, right? Like you could very easily do that. And then that becomes your agent.
And I think it's just kind of interesting to see people pick one or the other because it's either a reasoning model with tools that's going to be AGI, straight shot, you know, reasoning model with computer use is just smarter than every human, or it's, you know, a bunch of models that are good at predicting weather and predicting protein structures and et cetera. And I think the realization maybe over the next year that I'm having, 2 years, is that it's both. It's a reasoning model with compound AI systems that the model can use or help you use to perform weather predictions to do that. And yeah, I mean, the trend is just like bigger models get better at bigger problems. Meanwhile, somebody comes along a few months later and makes that model really small and can run really efficiently somehow. You can distill it, you can quantize it, you can do a bunch of stuff to make it run on less GPUs.
I think with the whole agent shift, you know, you're basically starting to see yet another rift in the AI space where you have these reasoning models that are multimodal and can do all kinds of different things and have a ton of tools. And then you have like the agent model, which is like one single modal model that can do one thing really, really well, right? Like that's kind of that I feel like that's rift is getting wider, right? With all this talk about agents and moving towards agents and stuff like that is like, yeah, you have some people going this way where like, I want a giant reasoning model that can do a little bit of everything, or I have this smaller purpose-built model like Mattergen that does one thing, but it does it really well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really interesting to see the impact this has on people, because the true compound system is like a person working with AI to do something, directing it to do something they know or need to do right now. So I'll give an example of this. Ethan Mollick on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever you follow, a great, you know, thinker. He's a professor at Wharton, he tweeted about some study that was done using Microsoft Copilot, which I think we've made fun of, but fundamentally it's just basically being used as a tutor, specifically the GPT-4 model. It's being used as a tutor in Nigeria. And for people who were behind, specifically girls in this study, 6 weeks of after school tutoring with an AI is the equivalent of 2 years of typical gains of learning. It's a massive improvement amongst the average person in their study.
Yeah.
And something else is basically, I don't have a tweet on this, but on the side, there's a school out there that has been doing this for a long time. I mean, you could say Khan Academy does this, but there's another network called Alpha School where they're basically developing AI powered apps to give to kids and let them do on the spot learning, like to prep for the SATs or something like that. And the results are staggering. Being able to have a back and forth with your tutor and making sure that that tutor is an absolute expert in the subject material is just a better learning experience than anything else that you can have. Watching videos, reading textbooks, anything.
Well, I think it underscores what we were just talking about with the whole like moving from VMware to KVM, making it easier by using a coding assistant, right? I mean, I think it just underscores that. It is faster for me to learn a programming language if I have somebody sitting right beside me who's an absolute expert in that language than it is for me to go read. Like, dude, I remember in high school, when I took a class on learning Visual Basic, I mean, that book was like, I'm not kidding you, like a dictionary. It was like this thick. And I took it for 2 years and I feel like I still didn't master Visual Basic. And so it's like, well, not only that, but like Visual Basic sucks for a lot of reasons. But the point is, right, like it took me 2 years and I still wasn't an expert. But like with this model of learning or this style of learning, right, where I've basically got a co-pilot that I can just ask any question that comes up during the normal course of what I'm doing, right? Like, I feel like I would pick up on things a lot faster, because one of the things like I found myself doing in those classes, for example, was like, I'm writing an application in Visual Basic and I can't remember how to write this specific function. So then I open up my dictionary book. I go to the glossary. I go to that. Okay. It's on page 137, these functions. So then I go to page 137 and I read the paragraphs and I look at the examples. I just spent 10 minutes when I could have easily just gone, how do I write this type of function? And I just get an answer in seconds.
Exactly. Yeah. It's I think a lot of people have this experience at the difference between learning theory only versus on the job training, basically. And it's just like the future is just OJT. Just give me a practice problem. Give me an example that's low stakes, you know, easy to get started with, and then people will start learning. And I think it's the rise of the I don't want to say polymath, but the, you know, jack of all trades, master of none style engineer.
Yeah.
It's basically it. And, you know, I think I've said this before on here, but there's this example I like to use. If you go back to like medieval times and you were to ask some aristocrat, you know, how many people can read? They'd be like, oh, only the top 5% of population are even capable of reading. All the peasants aren't capable of reading. And then slowly over time, it became obvious that actually, no, like most people can learn how to read, right? And And then you start to see, you know, okay, we teach calculus in university, and now it's taught in like grade 12 or even grade 11, some schools and different parts of the world teach it even earlier than that. The learning has always been based on time or age, but and people always emphasize a lot of depth with learning, but I really think that the models will encourage breadth of learning, which is something that I personally enjoy trying to learn other things. I mean, I don't know any other languages. Maybe that would be something to use a model with, as opposed to trying to go for Duolingo or something like that.
Or what's the other one? Rosetta Stone.
Yeah, such
That
stuff.
was
Yeah.
a I used Rosetta Stone in high school, like to assist me with learning Spanish, actually. So, but yeah,
Yeah.
what if you had a what if you had like a I don't know, because I remember when I was learning Spanish, my Spanish teacher told me that the best way to learn the language is to literally converse with someone else in Spanish.
Yeah,
So like
exactly.
if
That's
you
all in the job
had,
training.
yes,
Yeah.
if you had like an agent who only spoke Spanish and you could converse with it in Spanish, you're going to pick it up much faster than, you know, listening to an
And it'll
audio
correct you.
recording or something. Yeah, and it, yeah, exactly.
Actually, I
So
don't really get the pronunciation with that one, Hunter. It's pronounced Spanish. No, I don't know. Like, this model's going to be doing that to you. It'll really, I mean, yeah. So for those who want to have this experience, maybe not with the language learning thing, although I'm sure that'll come soon, and then suddenly I'll be actually talking Greek with my grandparents properly. But
Yeah,
the
that'll be interesting if we start doing this podcast in another language, because we both decided to go.
Bonjour, Hunter. Comment
Yeah.
ça va?
There you go.
Bienvenue.
Then we'd have to subtitle it though, so.
Yeah. I mean, I like 9 years of learning French in school up here in Canada out the window for me, but maybe we can bring it back. I talked about not learning languages previously on one of these episodes because, like, oh, the phone will just translate for me. And I was going around Japan, and it'll just do it for me. And I think that's good in a pinch. But if people have the motivation, obviously this is going to make things easier to learn or bring people together, which is what technology has always done.
Yeah, I mean that's how I got around Argentina, right? Like when I was in Argentina, I was just like, here, look at the phone, that's what I
Yeah. Yeah,
want.
I mean, exactly. The my favorite way is when you're traveling for work and then you just have somebody from the local team help you navigate around. That's always the
Yeah,
best.
there you go. Always good.
Like, yeah, my cousin in Greece was just like negotiating with taxi drivers. I'm watching the meter run up. I'm like, this is gonna be pretty expensive. The guy like gives him a pat on the back and then we walk out. It's like walking past lines and stuff. Yeah, different cultures are awesome. Okay, I don't know how to transition this, but I've got one more thing I want to talk about here as we kind of wrap. The Stargate stuff is obviously massive, right? And people have a whole bunch of different perspectives on this. Sam Altman and Elon Musk were going back and forth on at each other on Twitter. Some of the investors who invest in OpenAI or XAI are kind of criticizing it, and specifically Masa from SoftBank, going, the guy's got 38 billion in cash, 142 billion in debt. How is he going to fund this $500 billion project? But my favorite piece of this is Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella here. So let me try and play. I don't know if I can play the audio from this, but I'll just share the clip on here. He's doing an interview with CNBC, and he was asked about the tweets that Elon and Sam were sending back and forth. And he says, "All I know is I'm good for my 80 billion." But one of the really
What a
key
flex.
players in this is apparently not sure he's on the same page as Sam, the guy standing on stage with Larry Ellison and Masa-san with Trump. And talking about ordering pizza and wings for the weekend. Like, I don't know what if the guys are going with the meat lovers or the Hawaiian, but I just know that I'm good for my $10 and I'm getting my four slices, except it's $80 billion,
Yeah.
like all of their free cash flow, gigawatts of power. What are we doing here? And before I get, your reaction on this, let me just show one more tweet, which happened a week before this. Before the inauguration, before the big announcement, which was Dylan Patel from SemiAnalysis. I guess he doesn't just have a data center model now, he's got a private jet model where they're tracking Elon's jets in Florida, the GlobalFoundries jets in Florida, Qualcomm's jets in Florida, in case you're wondering what's going on with Intel. Previous administration with the CHIPS Act and the recent AI Act, basically barring NVIDIA from shipping GPUs to China, is now just doubling down. There's going to be apparently a $500 billion investment. Lots of new data centers. Something happening with Intel.
Yeah.
Something happening with not shipping GPUs to China. Maybe just, your reaction, but also just kind of puts a bow on the conversation about DeepSeek and how this is becoming like a race between nation states.
And that's my take still, right? I mean, you see, like, if something were to happen to Intel, it's what Intel's one of those companies that it poses a national security threat, right? I mean, it seriously, it does. Like, this is why Boeing is not allowed to fail, because they make shit for the DoD. Like, that's, anytime you're in that network, right? Like, you're simply not allowed to fail. So, like, if they decide to work something out where, like, Elon, Qualcomm, and Global, like, somebody else asked me about this, actually, that specific one. And I said, okay, that's fine. Let's play this out hypothetically. GlobalFoundries takes Intel's fab business, right? Makes a lot of sense. Qualcomm, maybe through some cash infusion of Elon, takes over the rest of Intel, right? And now it's, everybody's happy, right? Like, I could see that being a possibility that plays out. What's interesting about it is, like, GlobalFoundries was AMD's fab business before AMD decided they didn't want to be in the fab business anymore, and that became GlobalFoundries. What do we say to set effectively GlobalFoundries now makes Intel's and AMD's CPUs, right? If they take over the fab business. So, like, doesn't that run afoul of, like, some sort of antitrust regulation, or have we just thrown all those rules out the window at this point?
I don't know, but I just Googled. I don't know if this is right, but Intel current market cap $90 billion, current debt $72 billion, September 2024. That's like, or sorry, $50 billion USD. Sorry, I was doing Canadian with my nice Google search up here, but that's like a massive bailout. And
Yeah.
but the thing is, it's not a bailout. This is a functioning business selling CPUs to a whole bunch of people all over the world. They have a whole bunch of talented people that are doing great work. Somebody's just got to get the financials right and see this thing through. So I'm excited for the outcome of that. Let's see what happens. Kind of stay up to date on it. I want to give you one more thing to think about as we kind of wrap. I sent you a we're talking about nation states, we're talking about all this stuff. Two things on this. I've shared the Rich Sutton manifesto. I don't know what you would call it, but blank HTTP website called The Bitter Lesson, okay, in the past, which basically says AI progress is relentless, but it's because of processing power improvements, not because of model architecture improvements. And the new reasoning thing is clearly just going to scale up with more processing power. The second thing is the forecast from Ray Kurzweil. So here's the reference for Rich Sutton and The Bitter Lesson. Ray Kurzweil in 1999 theorized AGI by 2029. And he did this based on a super high level reference to how many flops our brain does, basically. He said by 2029, if Moore's law keeps up, we're going to have technology capable of a trillion calculations per second, and therefore we'll have AGI. Forget any of the software. And so somebody on Twitter, Miles Brundage, put together a Ray Kurzweil apology form, which everybody who doubted him is all happy to sign, because it is now January 2025. We have O1, we have open source DeepSeek V3 and R1.
Yeah.
And select your reason for apologizing to Ray Kurzweil.
I actually laughed out loud when you sent me this, because it's...
Read them for the audio only audience here. What are the options that you can choose when apologizing to Ray Kurzweil for doubting him?
Reason for behavior. The media convinced me that deep learning hit a wall. That killed me. I was biased against people who gave TED Talks. I was jealous of your hair. I thought you were too into the Turing test. I thought the nano stuff was weird, or my favorite, Mercury was in retrograde, which...
Oh, nice job, Miles. Yeah, this one was great.
That one cracked me up for quite a while. I thought it was really funny, because it's like he said 2029, here we are in 2025, and we're like, at least according to benchmarks, we're like, 98% of the way there. So 2029 seems to be the reality.
Yeah, we are currently sprinting to move the goalposts to say that this model that can basically solve any task I do given the right instructions is it's not going to hit whatever arbitrary AGI benchmark you pick in the next,
buddy. I'm still waiting for the model that cooks my dinner, man. I'm still waiting. Like I'm feeling, pasta aglio e olio tonight. Make it for me. Like,
I think you need to get an Italian model to teach you how to pronounce that pasta name properly. Actually,
No shit. I'm not saying it. I'm not saying that was an accurate presentation.
Here's the one. You see this model?
Yeah.
We showed the robot walking last week. This is a fun one of this model folding laundry, or this robot, not model. But man.
That's a pretty good shirt fold. I gotta say, like, that is a crisp fold.
Better than mine, dude.
Better than mine. Like, that's, I have OCD and I can't get it that good, man. Like, that's,
By 2029, do you think it's possible this gets better in the next 4 years, Hunter?
I mean, hey, dude.
In the next administration with $500 billion coming in and nuclear power plants, is it possible that this cup sorting, dishwasher putting away model gets better?
Yes.
All right. Well, this was fun.
It was. I guess till next week.
Yeah, something like that. Next week, next month,
next year,
maybe August. See you guys soon.
Bye.